Okay, so this afternoon, we're going to be, this section is going to be about ayahuasca, and part of the session will be about this new study that the field phase, the first phase of which has just been completed, that was sponsored by Botanical Dimensions, which is a nonprofit foundation that I'm affiliated with in some loose way, so I guess this is my opportunity to put a plug in for it. As usual, I don't have enough material, but I brought these. These are flyers, tell you where you can find out more information. There's only a few of them, but if you want to find out more about Botanical Dimensions and what it does and what it's trying to do, you can write to them at P.O. Box 807, Occidental, California, 95465. And, you know, it publishes a newsletter rather sporadically, but occasionally. And basically what the function of Botanical Dimensions is to foster the investigation of ethnomedical plants, the preservation of ethnomedical plants, not only psychedelic ones, but all plants that might have potential uses in medicine. But then we are sort of biased toward the psychedelic. And this ayahuasca project that was just completed is something that we managed to find, you know, using Botanical Dimensions nonprofit status as a platform, we managed to actually find investors, donate, people who gave charitable donations, who take a personal interest in seeing this work go forward. So we were able to carry off this study. We want to be able to do more of that sort of thing in the future, and if so, if we're going to be able to do it, we need your support. So anything that, you know, I mean, in doing this project, we've proven one thing. You don't need government support to do research on psychedelics. I mean, there are other venues. If you feel that this work is important, alternative ways can be found. And actually, our hope for this study is that the results will be solid enough and significant enough that they can be published in a peer-reviewed journal with a fairly high profile, or maybe a number of such peer-reviewed papers will appear. That's our hope. And that, as a result, the medical and psychiatric community will have to sit up and take notice and at least acknowledge that there is something here worth further investigations. So that's the strategy. We don't know what the results of the study are. We have some expectations. I don't have any results to show you yet. Just that we've only completed the field phase, and now the analytical work, the biochemical work, and so on, which I will describe, what we are going to measure, remains to be done. Our samples of plasma and plant samples and so on are all sitting in freezers in various universities across the country. But anyway, that is the thrust of the study, and we want to be able to do more similar things like that. So if you're interested, please pick one of these up. If you know of an angel who would like to endow us so that our main activity becomes doing research instead of trying to find funds to do research, we'd much appreciate that, because what we want to do is research. So I'll just, I don't know, you can pass them around or whatever. The other thing I wanted to mention to you in this context is that some of you may already have heard there's a new initiative going on. We just keep trying to find a way to do this kind of work, and the newest thing, the newest twist on this is that some of us have gotten together and formed, or we are in the process of incorporating right now, I should say, yet another nonprofit foundation called the Hefter Research Institute. And those of you who have sat in on some of the talks here probably know who Arthur Hefter was, and that probably sets you aside from 90% of the other people, even who express a specific interest in psychedelics. Arthur Hefter, of course, was the German pharmacologist and chemist who first isolated mescaline from the peyote cactus and ascertained that it was the active principle through self-experimentation. We chose his name because we feel that he exemplifies the scientific spirit in which these agents and these plants should be investigated. You know, proceeding carefully and methodically, but not afraid to, you know, confirm it using the best receptor or the best measuring instrument of all, which is your own mind. At any rate, the purpose of the Hefter Research Institute, if it ever gets going, and as I say, it is in the process of being incorporated, is to carry out research on psychedelics. But mainstream, no shit, good FDA, DEA approved scientific research protocols on these agents and their therapeutic potential and their metaphysical potential. It's what it really is, and this is kind of the subversive part, is that it's a program to investigate the mind. The psychedelics are the molecular probes that we can utilize to increase our understanding of the mind. And that's the purpose of the Hefter Research Institute, is to carry out, you know, both clinical and preclinical work. In other words, animal studies, chemical studies, structure activity investigations, the whole gamut of work that, you know, the good work that needs to be done and should continue to be done on these compounds. The people who are forming it are David Nichols, who is the original founder. He's the professor of medicinal chemistry and pharmacology at Purdue, and probably the leading mainstream researcher on the pharmacology and chemistry of these compounds. Rick Strassman, who many of you know, he already has FDA approval to work with DMT in humans. He's also on the board. Charles Grobe, who has secured FDA approval to work with MDMA in humans, and also was the co-investigator on this Huasca project in Brazil. He's a psychiatrist at UC Irvine. Other members, Philip Wolfson, who is a psychoanalyst who has worked for many years with MDMA, used it successfully in therapy. Mark Geyer, who's a behavioral pharmacologist at UC San Diego. So the personnel are there, and myself, and I, you know pretty much what my background is in ethnopharmacology, but the people are there. What we need now is the tools and the resources to be able to do it. I only have one copy of the Hefter Research Institute prospectus. I gave some others away. Any one of you who wants one can write to me or whatever, and I'll see that you get one if you're interested. Sorry for the protracted commercial interlude. Let me see. Anyway, this Huasca project, I guess what I'm going to do... is talk first a little bit about, to go at it in a kind of a chronological way, and talk first a little bit about how I got involved in all this. It goes back a long way. I don't want to tell you my whole life story, but in a nutshell, when I was a graduate student at the University of British Columbia, I had a long-time interest in these plants and these types of compounds. So my supervisor, Neil Towers, called me in and asked me if I wanted to go to Peru for 6 months to collect plants. He had some extra money in one of his grants. I basically dropped what I was doing and said that my bags were packed. So I and another graduate student went to Peru, and the among other things, the problem that I chose to investigate was an investigation, a chemical and pharmacological and ethnopharmacological investigation of ayahuasca, and a comparison of that with a similar substance, a similar orally active tryptamine hallucinogen from Varola called Ukue, which Professor Schultes had written about around 1970, he had first brought to the world's attention around 1970. I'm not going to talk about the Varola work very much at all. I'm going to concentrate on the ayahuasca work and just give you a quick recap. But to make the story more interesting, one of my fundamental questions was, these were both tryptamine-based drugs, DMT or 5-methoxy-DMT, and they were both orally active. The thinking had been in the ethnopharmacologic literature for many years that the mechanism behind this was that the beta-carboline alkaloids from the ayahuasca inhibited monoamine oxidase peripherally and allowed the DMT, which is normally not orally active, rendered it orally active by protecting it from degradation before it could be, so it could be absorbed and enter the nervous system intact. So that was accepted in the literature, but not really proven. Nobody had actually done any work to show that, in fact, ayahuasca was an MAO inhibitor. So that seemed like a trivial question and a kind of interesting question. The other thing that then there had been no quantitative chemical work done on it, or only one previous paper, Rivier and Lindgren's paper in 1972. And that was pretty much what was out there. The other aspect is the Varola, the orally active Varola preparations were completely unstudied. And I thought interesting from the standpoint of, here's a completely taxonomically different group. Varola is not that related to Banisteriopsis or Psychotria, but a similar chemistry and a similar postulated pharmacological mechanism. The only difference being that in the case of the Varolas, the tryptamines were the predominant alkaloid with traces or much smaller amounts of beta-carbolines. And in ayahuasca, the ratio was reversed. It was, you know, predominantly beta-carbolines with the tryptamine admixture being the critical determinant of whether you were to get visionary activity. So my question became, you know, do these two work by a similar mechanism? Is MAO inhibition also responsible for the action of the Varola preparations? And as I say, I'm not going to go into that, but just to summarize what I found, the results were unexpected in that many of the Ukuhe samples that I analyzed, I couldn't detect any beta-carbolines in, and those that did, which were only about two of approximately five or seven samples I analyzed, had only traces of beta-carbolines. Moreover, when I screened them in the MAO assay, they were poor to middling MAO inhibitors, and when I extracted the tryptamines out of them, they essentially lost that MAO inhibiting activity. So I concluded that with the Varola, the MAO inhibition didn't really or probably wouldn't explain the mechanism of action. Of course, the other thing is they weren't always active. There was quite a bit of chemical variation. So it's a chemical mishmash. I found with ayahuasca it was rather a more straightforward story. The pharmacology of the Ukuhe compounds really does need to be investigated somewhat further. There's a lot of work to be done. I might also mention that my colleague, Don McRae, who traveled with me in South America and was the other graduate student sent, decided to do his work on the aeropoison qualities of Varola and succeeded in extracting a fraction which was not the tryptamines, which was actually a lignan fraction, that showed a much more pronounced effect on the central nervous system of small animals, mice, I think he was using, than the tryptamine fraction. So there you know, for what it's worth, he concluded that the arrow poison action of the varolas was probably due to this lignan fraction. So, you know, there's more to the psychopharmacology of varola, I think, than is explained by the tryptamines. but as I say, with ayahuasca, the situation was somewhat more straightforward. This, of course, is Thanisteriopsis caapi, which is the source of the beta-carbolines and is the chief source of ayahuasca in the Amazon basin. And again, the chief source of the tryptamine alkaloids is Socotria viridis, which is shown here. This is probably used over 80% of the basin. One of the features of Socotria viridis, the distinguishing characteristic, are these little spines on the underside of the leaf, which that is kind of a signature for Socotria viridis, although other Socotrias have those structures as well. But these are meristematic zones, it turns out. I was told and swallowed for many years the notion that they were dolmatia, which is a structure that an ant or a parasite lives in, I believe. Dr. Schultes can correct me if I'm wrong. But there's no ant that can live in there. They're really pretty small, and they are growing kids. Now, this, unfortunately, is upside down. But this is the other major admixture plant that's used in Colombia and Ecuador. This is Diplopterus cabarena, formerly known as Thanisteriopsis wisbiana, and it is in the same family as Thanisteriopsis, as Jonathan Ott has already made clear to you. But it is an alternate source of DMT in some parts of the Northwest Amazon. Well, basically, making the ayahuasca, this is all done in Peru. I didn't have it too together when I put these slides in. These slides were taken by Luis Eduardo Luna, and this is Don Emilio, one of the curanderos that he studied with. After the bark is stripped off, it's boiled in a pot together with the leaves, and then after a couple of boilings, the liquid is drained off and combined, and then driven down to a smaller concentration. He was singing an Icaro and blowing tobacco into the ayahuasca pot, making an invocation. And tobacco is almost always constantly used in ayahuasca ceremonies in the mestizo, among the mestizo class in the Peruvian Amazon. This is a pipe made from a jungle tree, tawari, which is one of the plant teachers. And part of the technology of using ayahuasca in Peru has much to do with using ayahuasca in conjunction with other admixture plants. And the shaman uses it as a technology to learn about these other plants, and which they refer to as the plant teachers. And this is how they understand what they're good for and how, you know, what the biodynamic applications of these things are. That's just the pipe. Christian elements often are prominent in the mestizo use of ayahuasca. And usually the sessions are always group sessions. They're always at night. And, one or more ayahuascaros or curanpayes is probably the best term for them, is in charge. And they guide the session. They dole out the material and chant and blow tobacco smoke and do their curing. And this is a painting by Pablo Amaringo. Many of you know the Peruvian painter that Luis Eduardo Luna has studied with. And his recollection of his ayahuasca visions and his depiction of them in these paintings have really sort of opened up the world of Amazonian mythology to the study of anthropologists and so on. All of these visionary paintings have symbolic elements that have a coherent meaning, and they all fit into the mythology of ayahuasca in the Amazon. But in this visionary state, the iOS girl can divine and find the causes of illness and determine which plants to use to cure illness or apply other magical means to cure illness, such as songs, blowing tobacco smoke. The phlegm is another prominent element in the Peruvian ayahuasca cosmology, mythology. The phlegm is understood to be a magical substance produced within the chest, within the body, that the ayahuascaro can summon. It's a power substance. He can summon it in the process of curing, and he can use it to either cause harm or to cure, depending on his whether he's a brujo or not. And again, I think that the constant smoking has got something to do with the production of this phlegm. In fact, I'm sure that it does. Which is not to say that it's not real. I mean, this is a whole very interesting question about physiology. And you know, one of the things I should say, one of the things that prompted my interest in doing this whole study in Brazil, this whole biomedical study, even back in 1981 when we were doing this work, I thought, you know, these people really deliberately put themselves in a very strange place physiologically. You know, they follow a most peculiar diet. They smoke constantly. They take ayahuasca often several times a week, sometimes for days in a row. They don't sleep much. They work extremely hard. And they're as healthy as horses, you know, and, you know, mentally and physically. And I thought, this is similar to yoga in some ways. I mean, it's a physical hardening of the body. And so, you know, the question naturally arose, is there something measurable? What do you measure? You know, well, 10 years later, we muddled, you know, we passed something together, and we're not investigating, you know, if there is a magical or samadhi type psychophysiology here. We're not to that point yet. What we're doing with this study, this recent study, is to try to get some data points, that's all, just accumulate some information. There's no information now, so anything that you get is worthwhile, even if it's pretty ho-hum, which it may turn out to be. Anyway, curing in South America, in Peru, is a big, probably the chief reason for having these sessions. And the ayahuascaro will use the phlegm and suck out the offending, the object which causes disease, sometimes called a virote, is conceived as a dart-like or a thorn-like thing that's been put into the person by a brujo, and the ayahuascaro can use his phlegm and his power to take that out. And this is, you know, this is classic shamanism. This comes up again and again. He'll also make passes over the person's body, you know, using his hands or sometimes rattles made out of certain kinds of plants. And he will use medicinal plants as well, sometimes making poultices out of them, other times making a tea, other times adding them to ayahuasca and insisting that the person drink the ayahuasca. This is a depiction by Pablo Amaringo of some of the plant teachers. The plant teachers tend to be tall trees, very strong trees with a lot of alkaloids in the bark. There is probably, there's probably a pantheon of maybe 25 or 30 or so plant teachers, admixtures, that are more or less regularly used, and there's probably upwards of 100 that are occasionally used. Unexplored physiology. A lot of alkaloids in this group. Tryptamines and beta-carbolines are the active principles, of course, of the ayahuasca. So the question was, there were basically two objectives with the ayahuasca. One was to measure the MAO activity, the MAO inhibitory activity of the different ayahuasca brews. This is number two, measure the activity of the drugs as MAO inhibitors and determine which constituents are mainly responsible for the MAO inhibitory activity. Is there synergistic activity? does the same mechanism account for the oral activity of the varroa and the ayahuasca? I already said it didn't appear to. The first one was to identify and quantify the active constituents in the drug preparations and in the source plants. Look for differences between the two, if any. In other words, how much did the process of cooking and concentrating and all that, did it change the chemistry from the source plant significantly? And did the drug preparations contain physiologically active levels of alkaloids? Knowing what we know about what kind of doses are required to really get an effect, does the typical dose taken by a mestizo in this context, is it equivalent to that, or are they kidding themselves, or is it an overdose, or what? We have no information. So I used different techniques to quantify, to isolate and quantify the alkaloids, among which was HPLC, high-pressure liquid chromatography, and this just shows the elution diagram. Harmine was the main beta-carbamine, followed by tetrahydroharmine, followed by harmaline. Harmaline in benzotriopsis is basically a trace constituent. Tetrahydroharmine is much more abundant. In pagamum, it's the main constituent, I believe. And dimethyltryptamine. I also used a thin layer chromatography, two-dimensional thin layer chromatography, which is very easy to do and a very good way to get a quick qualitative idea of what's in the ayahuasca brews. This just shows a thin layer chromatogram of beta-carbamine under UV light. The beta-carbamines are nice and fluorescent, so when you shine a UV light on them, they fluoresce. This is harmine, and this is harmaline. I believe this is harmaline. And then these are the standard. So these are different brews. Those are easily picked up. Okay, I looked at a number of different samples of ayahuasca and compared their alkaloid content from different parts of Peru. And this is the harmine, tetrahydroharmine, harmaline, and DMT. This is the number of milligrams per gram dry weight and the percent of the total alkaloid fraction. And basically what I found was, if you look at the total alkaloid column over here, you see that there's a great deal of variation. The total alkaloids range from 75.6 milligrams per gram dry weight to 29.1. You know, so some are weak, some are strong. This really should surprise no one. Some had no DMT. This one from Tarapoto that was low on the beta-carbolines had no DMT. So they didn't use an admixture, or they didn't use the right admixture. Not clear. And then the levels of DMT also vary widely. So I guess this is belaboring the obvious, but at least we have numbers. The obvious being that the composition of these brews varies a lot between practitioners, between different ayahuascaros. You know, and again, I mean, it's hard to say. There's no control for, you know, how they were stored, how old they were. But then I also had the opportunity to form a friendship with these two gentlemen, Don Fidel Mozambique, and his friend, his mentor and teacher, Don Jose. And I was able to collect various batches of ayahuasca from that these ayahuascaros had made at different times, but all came from the same source plants and all came from the same garden and made by the same two people. And some was Don Fidel's and some was Don Juan's. I guess his name was Don Juan. And when I looked at it that way, it turned out that there was quite a bit of consistency between the alkaloid profiles of different batches made by the same people but at different times. Here's five different samples. Don Juan, number one, and number two. Don Fidel, number one, number two, and number three. And generally, they follow along pretty closely in that, you know, harmine is the main constituent, and, you know, it's about 66% of the total alkaloids. You know, the lowest is 53. Tetrahydroharmine, again, hovers right around 20 to 30% of the total alkaloids. Harmine, 5 to 6%.
harmaline, I mean, and DMT, you know, 10%, 7%, but pretty consistent across the board. You know, so I found for a typical 100 milliliter dose of this ayahuasca coming from these two practitioners, the average alkaline content, if you look here on the bottom row, I found basically there was 728 milligrams of alkaloid total in a typical 100 milliliter dose of these ayahuascas averaged out. And 470 milligrams of that was harmine. 160 milligrams was tetrahydroharmine. 41 milligrams was harmaline, and 60 milligrams was DMT. So that kind of answers the question in this sense. There is enough DMT to be above threshold. The threshold of DMT when taken parenterally, when smoked, for example, is around 30. So there's plenty of DMT to be above threshold, and there's certainly enough of the beta carbolines to inhibit MAO, but probably not enough of the beta carbolines to be doing much on their own in terms of psychoactivity. Harmine is not that active, even up to a gram has been reported inactive. Similarly, the monoamine oxidase activity this is percent of MAO inhibition, and this is decreasing concentrations. So obviously undiluted brews, or just, you know, cleaned up brews, but undiluted, give 100% inhibition. And as you start diluting them by orders of magnitude, you don't really get a significant reduction in activity until you've gone to about 10 to the minus 7. So you've diluted it to a factor of 10 million, and even at that point, it still inhibits, you know, close to 50% of the alkaloid, of the enzyme activity. So it is a strong MAO inhibitor. I also looked at DMT and harmine and harmaline mixtures of the pure compounds, ayahuasca analogs, if you will, that were present in either equimolar concentration or the same concentration as I found in the ayahuasca. And basically, the take-home lesson is there was no synergistic effect. They didn't seem to. They were additive, but not synchronistic. So the conclusion is active constituents of ayahuasca, the major alkaloids detected were harmine, tetrahydroharmine, DMT, and harmaline in that order. And a typical 100 ml dose contains about 730 milligrams total of alkaloid, of which 65% is harmine, 22% is tetrahydroharmine. 8% is DMT and 5% is harmaline. And a typical dose contains between 20 and 70 milligrams of DMT, which is a physiologically active concentration, and sufficient concentrations of beta carbolines to inhibit MAO, but not enough to be hallucinogenically active themselves. And as I already said, the only thing I didn't mention here, I mean, the ayahuasca brews were highly active as MAO inhibitors. This should surprise no one. The SAR studies of the beta carbolines, I looked at some different beta carboline derivatives and found that harmine was the most active of the three main constituents, so more active than harmaline or tetrahydroharmine as a monoamine oxidase inhibitor. And I found no evidence of synergistic action. Okay, so that's what I did in 71, and that was part of my thesis work. So now we can flash forward to 1993. Or actually, we can flash forward to 1991. And in 1991, I was invited to attend a conference in Sao Paulo, put on by an organization called the UDEVE, a Brazilian organization that is basically a syncretic church, an ayahuasca cult that in Brazil where ayahuasca is known either as wasca or the vegetal, or sometimes just the tea, cha. An interesting phenomenon has occurred, which is there has developed the appearance of these syncretic religious movements. These are not who use ayahuasca ritually in their ceremonies, and they have a complex doctrine. They're very moral, and it's kind of like a fundamentalist Christian cult, only without the emphasis on the Christian elements. Their thing is about the tea, and about the, really on the metaphysical level, about the plant-human alliance. I think. I mean, it's very ecologically oriented, and it's very ethically oriented. But what's interesting is that the members are largely not mestizo. There is a big mestizo or caboclo component, as it's called in Brazil. But also there are many middle-class members and many professionals, including doctors, psychiatrists, scientists, people like that. So this conference was hosted by a subsection of the UDV that was assigned for medical studies. And they hosted this conference, the first international conference on the tea, and they invited a number of people to give talks at this conference, and then they invited me because of my previous work. So I went down and I gave a talk. I spent a very pleasant couple of days with them, and I brought up this idea of doing a biomedical study of ayahuasca, which Eduardo Luna and I had written up in 1985 after we'd come back from Peru, but you know, couldn't get anyone to listen really, and didn't really press it. But I brought it up to them, and they said, well, that's great. That's what we want to do. So it turns out that we decided to, you know, collaborate, and I suggested that we try to get funding through Botanical Dimensions. So I went back and wrote a proposal. Originally, we were going to submit a grant to NIDA, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, try and get a government research grant to do this. Well, the more I wrote into this proposal, the more I worked on it, the more I realized it'll never fly. So I thought, well, why don't we just try and find some wealthy contributors or semi-wealthy contributors and get it going that way. So we sort of used the connections we've made to through Botanical Dimensions. There are people who help support it and have given substantial gifts, and so we contacted these people, and it actually was pretty easy. They were happy to help, and so as a result, we were able to collect $75,000, primarily from three main donors who I won't mention, but I would like to acknowledge their help. Without them, this couldn't be done. But I'm not going to say their names. I'm sure lots of you know who they are. At any rate, we were able to get this money. Now, had we done this in the States, and as it became clear as we were doing the study down there, the work that we were able to accomplish for $75,000 would have taken 2 years and cost probably $500,000 to $1 million. But because we had all this cooperation from the UDV down there, and because we were enthusiasts, we were able to get a lot of things done for a lot much less, much more than I ever dared hope we would be able to do. So we got this money, and the field phase of this took about 2 years. So 2 years later, it's now 1993, and we got the money together, the financing together, the previous fall, basically. So in June and July, Charlie Grobe and I and Jace Calloway from the University of Kuopio in Finland. Charlie Grobe is from Irvine. Annalise Schinzinger, who's a member of the UDV and who acted as our translator and guide and has been just tremendous with everything she's done, went down there, and we met with our Brazilian colleagues, primarily Glaucus de Souza
Brito, who's the head of the medical studies section at the UDV and was the medical coordinator on the Brazilian side. So we went down, we all traveled in to Manaus. Manaus is the largest city on the Amazon, and it's a center of concentration of the UDV. There's some of the oldest temples are there. The UDV's been around, you know, 30 years or so. But some of the oldest temples are there. So we went to Manaus. There were plenty of volunteers. People were really eager to be involved in this study. I mean, such enthusiasm, you know. So we went there, and we carried out this study. And if I had an overhead projector, I would use it, but I don't. So I will just summarize what the initial objectives of this study were. First of all, we wanted to measure physiological effects, you know, whatever we could measure. This is a data gathering study, you know, so we don't know exactly what the results will be. Any information is new information. So that was the sort of the spirit in which we approached this. We were interested, first of all, in long-term effects that might be measurable. Many of these people take ayahuasca regularly, on an average of once a week, sometimes several times a week, for years, most of their adult life. They appear to suffer no ill effects. They appear to be extremely healthy people. Many of the older ones, you know, are now pushing 80, and I can tell you if I'm in that shape when I'm 80, I'll be real happy. But again, you know, without making judgments whether this was good or bad, our question was, are there long-term effects? Can you discern a biochemical marker of some sort in the people that take the stuff versus a similarly matched control group where people don't take it, and otherwise a similar matched group? So we focused in on blood platelets as a good model. In psychopharmacology, in the psychopharmacology of depression, for example, blood platelets in some ways are considered a peripheral model of the central serotonin system. Blood platelets have serotonin receptors on them. Many of the same receptors are similar to those that are found in the central nervous system serotonin system. Treatment with antidepressants, psychiatric medication, will cause these platelet receptors to up and down regulate, to vary in numbers over time as you give them, as you tweak them with various serotonergic agents. Platelets also have monoamine oxidase, so you can get a handle on that. So we decided to look at platelets because, you know, there's some controversy as to whether it's really a true reflection of the central nervous system, but it's a peripheral handle, you know, and you can't really ask these people to donate their brains, you know. So what we want to do, we took plasma samples from 15 subjects, volunteers, who had all drunk ayahuasca at least 10 years, and we had a similarly matched control group, age and sex matched. The work was all men initially. Apologies to the women, but that's the next phase. We thought, just to keep things simple, we'd hold to one sex in this initial study. And we took platelet samples from a group of 15 matched controls, or actually I think we ended up with 13 controls. And Jace Calloway at the University of Cupio is going to do the platelet receptor binding and the MAO assays. He has techniques set up to do this. The two receptors that we want to look at, serotonin receptors, are the 5-HT2 receptors, which we'll use ketanserin and tritiated ketanserin, radioactive 5-HT2 antagonist, and iodine-125 labeled DOI, which is a psychotomimetic phenethylamine or a hallucinant psychedelic phenethylamine. And both of these label the 5-HT2 receptors. So we're going to look at that to see if we can determine any modulation, basically, in the density of the receptors, either the affinity of the receptors four different substrates, or the overall density, the so-called B max of the receptors. We're also going to look at the 5-HT transporter molecule, the 5-HT carrier, which is also found in the platelets, which can be labeled with a compound called citalopram, or sometimes they use another one called paroxetine. These are selective serotonin uptake blockers. These are the receptors that are on the platelets, and these are the ones that you would expect the ayahuasca to modulate. I mean, these are the ones that they, in terms of what we know about its pharmacology, that should be what it modulates. We also measured any other acute, the other aspect of the physiological study was acute effects. Physiological responses, obvious ones, heart rate, blood pressure, body temperature, pupillary diameter. In other words, this is when we gave ayahuasca to, we took the same group of 15 subjects. We had them come in pairs or groups of three, actually, mostly, and they all got dosed with ayahuasca. And then at different time points, we measured these physiological parameters for a period of about up to 24 hours following administration. We also did, the other two things we did in the acute study, or will do, is pharmacokinetics. We drew blood samples at different times after the administration and put those on dry ice, spun the things down in a centrifuge and collected the plasma, froze those on dry ice, and those are going to be analyzed for DMT and harmine, possibly other metabolites, but those two, by Kim Fall at the UCLA Medical Center. The other aspect of the acute study was a neuroendocrine challenge. We also took aliquots of plasma samples and froze those, and we're going to look at different hormone levels. We're using, this is a variation on the so-called tryptophan challenge test. You can give tryptophan to intravenously to challenge your serotonergic system. Well, we're giving, instead of tryptophan, we're giving ayahuasca, and we're looking for a hormonal response in hormones like prolactin, ACTH, cortisol, and I believe we're also going to look at beta endorphins. So that's the physiological aspect. The psychological study was that basically two, we used different psychological instruments, different questionnaires, different screening scales. One was the hallucinogen rating scale, which Rick Strassman developed with his DMT work.